When all is ready, I throw this switch.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast where we discuss the famous and infamous runs and story arcs throughout the history of comics. I don't know why I'm pausing, but I will continue.
Okay, Shatner.
With me, as always, as you already heard, is Mr. Brian Reese.
Hello. Hi. I'm here.
You are here. I'm Paul Matthew Carr, by the way. Didn't introduce myself. So anyway, hi. Today on the program, we will be discussing Hellblazer, Original Sins by Jamie Delano and John Ridgway, which is, you know, one of those nice, warm, makes you feel good comics.
Yes. This is a cozy comic.
Yes. But first, before we do that, so this is actually a couple weeks ago now at the time of this recording, but a couple of trailers came out for some new upcoming movies, and The Mandalorian Season 3 has just ended, so we're going to talk about that right now.
All right.
Let's start with the Blue Beetle trailer. Wow, I am off today, Brian. I am just rambling for some reason.
Me too. This could be a fun one. So folks, I already warned Paul that I'm a little off today. Like, I'm just, you know, it's that do I feel good? Do I not feel good? I don't think I feel good, but I don't have symptoms of anything. I'm just kind of like, eh.
Yeah.
Boy, Hellblazer is a good one to do when you're feeling a little off.
Yeah. My mind keeps going blank for some reason. Let's talk about Blue Beetle. Let's talk about Blue Beetle. So first, I want to get your thoughts on this. I will admit I'm not as well-versed in Blue Beetle as you are. I am aware of the character, but I haven't read a lot of his comics. Or a lot of the comics. However, I did spend the entire trailer saying, Jamie Reyes, Jamie Reyes, Jamie Reyes, come and rock me, Jamie Reyes.
Jamie Reyes.
So anyway, what were your initial thoughts on this trailer?
I think it looks awesome.
Yeah.
I think, just as a history, so there are people who are grouchy. Imagine that in the comics world, grouchy fans, because it's Jamie Reyes and not Ted Kord. And I'm like, I love the Jamie Reyes Blue Beetle. Love it. I think that when Keith Giffen and when Jamie Reyes was first introduced as Blue Beetle, I thought it breathed a lot of fresh air into the character because Ted Kord was dead at the time. I, to be honest, I'm not certain if he's alive again. I think he is. I can't tell. He is alive because in the latest Blue Beetle with Jamie Reyes, Ted Kord is present. But I love the iteration of Blue Beetle that is Jamie Reyes. So like when I saw they were doing a film, I was like, ooh, how's this going to work? And then I was like, oh God, they're going to Snyderverse it and it's going to be like dark and weird. And oh no, this looks fun.
Yeah, that was my thought too. I also thought Blue Beetle must be using Wi-Fi because they're cordless.
Hello.
Thank you very much, everybody. But no, I just thought it looked bright and there was jokes and people seemed, you know, nice to each other. No, but it looks good. I can only imagine, I haven't seen anything online yet, but I can only imagine fanboys are going to go losing their minds because it looks like the spider suit.
I think there will be comparisons, and even watching the trailer, I get where they're going to kind of try to Tom Holland this, and that's fine.
It works. The Tom Holland stuff is fun. If they do that kind of tone, I'm okay with that.
Yeah, and I think that's what it looks like, is it looks like fun, which is what the Jamie Reyes Blue Beetle, it's Keith Giffen. Keith Giffen, yeah. You know, I realize he hasn't written the character in a long time, but that's how he was created. And my goodness, I thought the original series with Jamie Reyes was a lot of fun. And so I think it's an interesting choice.
It's different. I like that.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And you can always bring in Ted Kord later. You know, it's sure. the same way they started with Ant-Man with Scott. Mm-hmm. Can't remember his last name right now. Scott Lang. Yeah. So they started with Scott Lang, which made sense. And then they brought in Hank Pym for later stuff. And as a sort of a mentor figure, it's fine. It's fine. But now this looked really good. And there's a couple of funny jokes about Batman's a fascist. I like that. You know,
which is always a funny joke to make.
Yes, it is. But it looked good. It looked fun. I know there's going to be inevitable comparisons to Tom Holland and to Tony Stark, with the because with the voice, the Jarvis kind of voice in the suit.
Yeah.
But that's God, that kind of stuff happens in comics. All that stuff is everybody cannibalizes each other.
Yeah, but the scarab that is, well, I don't want to get into too much detail, but it's such a completely different character, and the origin is completely different, and it's about alien technology. I understand that the preview is trying to invest people in a certain idea about what Blue Beetle's about, but it's very different. I think it'll be very interesting. I am invested in this movie being good. I really hope it's good.
I do too. I was a little skeptical at first when I first heard about it being announced, because same as you, I thought, oh, great, Blue Beetle Snyder version. But this actually is out. It looks fun. One of the things about this trailer that I have to shout out and say, kudos DC, the very last panel, it shows the comics it will be based on. Awesome job, DC. That was fantastic. To the point where I work at a library, I went out and got the first trade by Keith Gibbon, Blue
Oh,
Beetle
nice.
Under Arrest. So I have that. I haven't read it yet, but I'm going to. I say I'm not well versed in Blue Beetle. I will be very soon.
Yes.
So I like that. I think all comic book movies should start doing that and say, hey, these are the comics we're going to base this on. Go out and get started and get a little background. That was very cool.
Yeah.
So we're both on board with Blue Beetle. We'll talk very quickly about the Marvels. You haven't seen this, or you
I
haven't
haven't
watched.
seen the trailer. I didn't know we were. You may have mentioned, I think, 4 weeks ago.
Yes. Well, the gist of this is another one that looks a lot of fun. Looks like a lot of fun. The gist of it is because there's going to be Carol Danvers, Captain Marvel. There's going to be Ms. Marvel, Kamala Khan.
Yay.
Yeah, and Photon, forgetting her name right now. So those three, which have similar powers, at least from the trailer, what it seems like is every time they're connected somehow, and every time each one of them use their powers, they switch places. Kind
Right,
of like,
which was set up in the original in the Miss Marvel
right. So they switch places. Well, that's the whole thing. So they all have to team up and be in the same room when they fight, so that when they switch places, they're all, there's some funny gags in the trailer where Kamala Khan is in her living room. She shows off her powers, and then suddenly Carol Danvers comes flying in from the ceiling, and Kamala Khan
As one
switches pla
does.
yeah, well, switches places from her, and Kamala Khan is now in the sky falling. So anyway, so funny gags like that. Nick Fury's in it.
Well, of course he is.
Well, no, see, the thing is, this takes place after Secret Invasion. So is it Nick Fury? Is it a Skrull? What's going on?
I don't know.
Yeah. That's another trailer that came out recently, the
Right, I
Secret
know
Invasion.
Secret Invasion is coming too, and
That actually looks pretty decent, to be honest with
yeah,
you.
I'll watch it. I mean,
Absolutely. But anyway, the Marvels looks fun. I am not looking forward to, again, the inevitable fanboy backlash and all the endless YouTube videos about
well, we're
Captain
going to get
Marvel.
that with Blue Beetle as well.
Not looking forward to that, but I
Because he's Hispanic, and so they'll
yeah, but
garbage is coming. Well, I think garbage is probably already out there.
Yes, I'm trying to shield myself from that because it's
Oh,
just,
I see what you did there.
hey, I didn't do that
Oh, well, you know,
on
but
Nicely done, me. So yeah, I just, these are comic books, people.
yeah.
This is not Citizen Kane. This is not The Godfather. This is goofy comic books, and they're supposed to be silly and fun. You could talk about serious stuff, but
Sure.
you could
And
have
we're going to
serious
be talking
tones.
about some serious stuff today.
Yeah.
As serious as you can get with demons and bugs and what have you, but yeah,
But overall, comics should be fun. I mean, and
they're
this is a
fun.
guy, I want to make this clear. I mean, I read horror comics a lot, and I'm not saying that horror comics should be whimsical, but they should be, entertaining. And there's a tone of unreality that comes with it. It can be serious in subject matter, but it doesn't have to be dour all the time.
Well, and I feel like we're often we're kind of beating we've been beating the same drum for a while now in reaction to what I think is a minority of
A very loud minority.
a very loud minority of fussy people who have a level of self-seriousness that maybe I don't know. I don't know what to say. I get tired of like having to argue with these idiots. And
Yeah.
I
Well,
you know, and just go get laid, you know.
I have to, and the majority of these people who are so fussy about these sort of things are of a certain age. And coming at this, as a man in his 50s, reading comic
They're
books.
kids our age.
Exactly. So, but when I come at these things, I have to say, I am not the demographic. So if something seems a little childish, I don't get mad because, oh, they ruined it. You know, it's like, no, they made it for other people that are not me. So I enjoy it for what it is rather than, what I think it should be. Anyway, this whole thing, the reason I keep hammering this, because it just seems like fandom is getting, you guys are getting out of control. Just take it down a notch. You don't have to like everything, but you don't have to hate everything either.
Well, and you don't have to elevate everything. One doesn't have to elevate everything they don't like into a culture war or some apocalyptic end of the world scenario. It's comics.
Exactly.
It's comics.
Let's move on now. The season three of The Mandalorian has come out, and it is a bit, to get back into fandom again, there's a lot of people who were not on board with this particular season. So
That's
it's.
weird. Like, I guess I'm divorced from some of this nonsense, because Baby Yoda in an IG
88 or whatever it is. Yeah.
88, or I think this is 11.
This droid goes to 11.
How is that not fun? Who doesn't enjoy this? What
Yeah.
is wrong with people who don't enjoy that?
And it's Taika Waititi saying, yes, no. I think what people, oh wait, by the way, you think comic book fans are nitpicky? Star Wars fans, whoo boy, that's they're through the roof. But I think what people, so one of the major criticisms I've seen is that the cliffhanger from last season was resolved in the Book of Boba Fett. So people had a little problem with that, saying, a major story point was taken care of in a different show. So
Except the Book of Boba Fett was basically Mandalorian season 2.5.
it is exactly. I think, if you just look at all these series, including Obi-Wan and all that, of just chapters in a very long book. In fact, the Mandalorian is even broken up into chapter one, two, three, four. Think of it as a serialized story. You go to the movies every week, you see a little mini serial. That's what you're seeing. So anyway, I didn't get too fussed about that. And then the other big criticism was there's too much, this is crazy, too much Mandalorian stuff, not focusing on Din enough.
Wait, remind me what the name of the show is.
Well, it's the Mandalorian, not the Mandalorians.
Gee whiz.
I know. I get it. There's a lot of Mandalorian lore that if you're not privy to, it can get confusing. Now, see, I watch all the animated stuff.
Which I haven't. So, like, I'm coming into this without some of the lore.
Yeah. So I know the whole
And I don't
history.
mean Data's brother. No, but so I think it was explained pretty well.
I mean, I think now, see, like I said, I watched all the animated stuff, so I've seen all those. I've seen the introduction of Bo-Katan and her revolution and her whole story arc throughout the animated stuff. So I know what's going on there. I know about the different sects that have broken off the Night Watch, which became Children of the Watch, and all that stuff is there's stories about it in the animated things. So when I watch it, I know all this stuff, and it's just cool to me. By the way, Katie Sackhoff voices Bo-Katan in the animated stuff. So it's nice that she came back in live action. Yeah, so I but yeah, so I, that's what I was going to try to ask you was for someone who doesn't know all this backstory, you got the gist though, right?
I got the gist. I don't need, like, I'm happy, I like Pedro Pascal. It's a great actor. We got a lot of him in another recent series, also involved with saving a child.
That's just going to be his thing now. Daddy Pedro and this saving the child.
But we don't see his face anyway, so settle down. Everybody, just settle down. At the end of the day, all these little Boba Fetts running around and all these little baby Yodas, that's gonna really tick people off. They're all Boba Fetts and Yodas.
Yes,
Wow,
exactly.
no, it's actually, but I think it's awesome. I
Yeah.
want more Boba Fetts.
Yes, I want more Boba Fetts, and I want more. You know what? Seeing Mandalorians with a drop out of the spaceship and start flying around. What more could you possibly want? Boba Fett's with jetpacks flying around.
Well, I think we got more action scenes in The Mandalorian than we did in the last three official Star Wars films. I really enjoyed this season of The Mandalorian. You know, and I think what they're doing with Grogu, I'm sorry, but it, again, not to go back to it, but putting him in an IG, you know, droid, yeah. That's just genius. It's just genius. It's just great. It's yes. Why we enjoy life.
Exactly. It's just fun. No, I like it. And I love the fact that they, you know, oh, by spoilers for this, if you haven't seen season three, by the way, it's a little late in the game for that. But the fact that he is officially adopted by Pedro Pascal and then he's Din Grogu. And I was like, huh, Din's his last name. Interesting. Mm-hmm. I didn't know that. Yeah, so I just thought I there's so many. There were some good space and fighter action scenes.
Yeah,
with TIE fighters and it was just like This is what we want.
Yes, is there some sketchy plot holes and do some things not make as much sense? Or is there a payoff in certain areas where maybe it could have been something bigger? Sure.
Like there's things like, okay, so one of the criticisms is, you know, they have the Darksaber and it, you know, you need to have the Darksaber to roll and you can only win it in combat.
Right.
And Din Djarin found a loophole to be able to give it back to Bo-Katan. So people lost their shit over that, of course, because they didn't fight for it. And I thought, no, that's actually growth on Din Djarin's part because he didn't have to fight. His whole point is he wants to unify all the Mandalorians. He wants to bring everyone to come together. So he found a peaceful resolution that everyone can agree on without having to fight each other. I thought that's actually quite a good plot point.
Yeah.
Pretty good writing there, I thought. But of course, they didn't fight. And then of course, the other thing that everybody got upset was Lizzo and Jack Black having cameos.
And Doc Brown.
And Doc Brown. Well, he was great. Christopher Lloyd is just a good actor. He was a Klingon, for God's sakes. He could be anything.
I understand that part of it. It didn't bother me, but I also felt like it was unnecessary.
And again, this gets back into
what I needed, but at the same time, I'm not mad about it.
No, this gets back into what I was saying about I'm not the demographic. Mm-hmm. Because my daughter, who's not a Star Wars fan, despite her entire life of me trying to make her so, she does not like anyway. But anyway, she did happen to watch that episode with friends and was absolutely thrilled. She was like, hey, Lizzo, look how cool she is. I'm like, okay, you're the demographic, not me. So
was it stunt casting? Does it matter? No. Because, you know, I like Lizzo fine. I love Jack Black. I'm always happy to see Jack Black. I mean, you know, he wasn't singing about peaches, but still, there he was. You know, it just...
It was the greatest cameo ever.
Is it... did I feel like it really added anything to the series? No, not really. But do I care? No.
It was supposed to be a lighter episode to try to...
Yeah.
You know, to try to relieve the tension because everything was getting a little bit lore heavy and
somebody referred to it as a Scooby-Doo episode. And I was like, okay,
that's sure. Fine.
And they didn't do it negatively. They were just like, oh, that was their Scooby-Doo episode. Yeah. I was like, okay, sure. Yeah.
Every once in a while, a series has the fluff episode, the lighter one, the comedy episode. Yeah. That's what this one was. And it's fine. They did a little little noir detective through the city. Go into bars and, you know, it was
fun. As bad as Ed Sheeran in Game of Thrones? No! Jack Black and Doc Brown serve purposes.
Yeah, I didn't even mind that, Ed Sheeran. Yeah. He was a balladeer. It's fine. No, it was a fine little episode. I just, you know, it was entertaining and it was fun. And that's all it was meant to be. There's a kind of YouTuber video essayist named Patrick H. Willems. Which if anyone hasn't watched any material by Patrick H. Willems, go do so because he's amazing and he's really good. But he has made the point that you always have to keep in mind that Star Wars is a franchise about space wizards meant for children. That's what it is. And don't try to make it so precious. It's space wizards meant for children. There you go. That being said,
so I think basically what we've said is that we're at least you and I are very excited about things that other people are really mad about.
Exactly. And then at the very end, they have their little homestead and Grogu is floating frogs. While dad kicks back on the porch and he's probably going to whittle some.
They do the Looney Tunes closeout.
Exactly. The little iris close. Yeah. I thought that was fantastic.
Yeah.
Real quick, to cap this off, Andy Serkis has been confirmed that his character will be back in Andor season 2.
What? That's like spoilerific. Like,
well, he didn't die.
Well,
he just didn't jump.
Well, we didn't see him live either.
That's true. Anyway, it could be. Now it could be
news. That's great news.
It could be that it might just be flashbacks. You never know.
Or it could be that he's playing somebody else, like a space golem.
Yeah, maybe he's Snoke.
Oh, right.
Yeah, it could be Snoke.
Or he's King Kong. Or is an ape on the Planet of the Apes. I mean, who knows?
Oh, that would be great. Caesar, Gollum, and King Kong all are going to be in this. This is going to be great.
Someone needs to give Andy Serkis an honorary Oscar.
Absolutely. Yeah, so that'll be fun. Excited about Blue Beetle. Excited about the Marvels. You should watch that trailer. And Mandalorian Season 3, a hell of a lot of fun.
I enjoyed it.
We like stuff, Brian.
We were, I was talking to some friends recently, you know, like I used to write a music website that had some notoriety for a while. But, you know, like one of the things people always ask me, they were like, you never criticize the music you write about. I was like, well, why? I'm only writing about bands I like. Why would I write about bands I don't like? Who cares? You know, I'm not a critic, but it's just, it is. It's one of those things. It's like, at some point, who cares? Like, obviously, we talk, sometimes you and I talk about comics that we, you know, we recommend comics. Sometimes we like them. Sometimes we don't. Sometimes I think I recommend something I think I'm going to like. And then I was like, ooh, that was a bad recommendation.
Well, there's a difference between not liking something and it being bad.
Right.
Or there's things like you can find things that, you know, things that maybe don't work, but you can also find things that do.
Right.
You know, not everything is just good or bad. It's not binary.
Yeah.
There's always going to be good and bad things in every comic you read. For instance, we're going to take a break and come back and talk about Hellblazer.
So the cheerful level was just going to go up a notch.
Exactly. So let's take a break and we'll come back and talk about Hellblazer.
Need a podcast talking about weird stuff? Well, then we've got just the thing for you. Into the Weird, a podcast chronicling the madness and magnificence of the mighty Marvel Bronze Age of comics, featuring the voice talents of Mr. Billy Delicious.
Hola.
Mr. Herman Hellstrom Lowe.
Hey there.
And straight from the Long Box of Darkness, His Infernal Majesty Dormammu.
How are you?
And many more. But wait a minute. You might be thinking, aren't all comics infused with a grain of weirdness? I mean, Reed Richards can stretch every single part of his body, right? And why did Ultron design the Vision with working genitalia? Well, you would be correct, but Into the Weird isn't just any regular comic book show, folks. We focus on the really bizarre. Here are a few examples.
A sword and sorcery barbarian grown spontaneously from a jar of peanut butter.
A duck running for president of the United States.
Benjamin Franklin playing hide the sausage with Doctor Strange's girlfriend, Clea.
A giant-sized man-thing lamenting the death of a clown.
A serial killer obsessed with killing only fools, dressed as cavalier with laser guns after witnessing a priest fornicating.
And so much more. So if you like the wonderful weirdness of the Bronze Age from 1970 to 1985, and characters such as Ghost Rider, Morbius, The Defenders, Man-Thing, Son of Satan, Skull the Slayer, Killraven, Howard the Duck, and the weird granddaddy of them all, Dr. Stephen Strange, then this is the show for you.
ITW's on iTunes, Stitcher, Podbean, and TuneIn. Hit subscribe and join us for a comic-filled jaunt into the weird.
And we're back. Brian, this week is your recommendation
It sure is.
Go on, tell us about it.
All right. In 1984, noted musician Gordon Matthew Thomas Sumner made a brief cameo in issue 25 of the comic book Swamp Thing, wearing a black and red striped t-shirt. A year later, he would appear again in Swamp Thing number 37, magically transformed, possibly through the powers of tantric sex, into the character of John Constantine, or JC to his close friends. After a myriad of wacky and lighthearted adventures throughout the DC universe, the wise powers that be decided to give John Constantine his own ongoing comic book, Hellblazer, in 1988. In today's world of comics, this title would be lucky to last six issues before being given the axe. But Hellblazer ran for an astonishing 300 issues. 300 issues. A large portion under the Vertigo banner. Writers on the title included Jamie Delano, Garth Ennis, Mike Carey, Warren Ellis, Brian Azzarello, Neil Gaiman, Grant Morrison, Peter Milligan, and Andy Deagle, amongst others. Notable artists were Simon Bisley, Mark Buckingham, Richard Corbin, Steve Dillon, and Sean Phillips. That's probably all one really needs to know. But wait, there's more. Ostensibly a horror comic, Hellblazer deals with all manner of dark themes, supernatural, religious, personal, and political, and was often considered quite controversial both in subject matter and imagery. And John Constantine is easily one of the most memorable characters in the four-color medium, with his spiky blonde hair, ever-present trench coat, and tie askew, an amoral moralist of the highest order. And as one of the most powerful magicians in the DC universe, Constantine finds himself more in the grittiest and grimiest corners, far from the histrionics of his caped contemporaries. Original Sin collects the first nine issues of Hellblazer. Written by Jamie Delano and grotesquely illustrated by John Ridgway, these stories set a template for the character and his world, introducing a supporting cast that will have far-reaching influence and consequences for the entirety of the series. We take the measure of a man and all his flaws and find him at a crossroads that he never escapes from. A great intro to the laughing musician and a harrowing series of events, Struth. Okay, so.
All right. Well, first of all, I want to say, you said your introduction was going to be boring. I didn't find that boring at all. Especially when you start with Gordon Sumner.
Very nice. As one does.
Yeah. It's always nice to start with a sting.
It does. Yes. You know, I try to police the type of references I make, but.
This is so much fun. So yeah, Hellblazer. One of those classic comics that, you know, I think we're both going to have praise for this. Most of the way through. Yeah, some things don't stand up, and I will have a few things to say about Jamie Delano's particular writing style.
The purple prose?
Oh, God. There are some, we'll get into it. But
we could just get this out of the way right at the top. I mean, this is Delano's great, and I like a lot of his work. But, I mean, this dude's going full Victorian on us. And
oh, my goodness. You know, the Scouse accents aside, which it might be accurate. That's right. Fine. But yeah, but that's the whole, you know, call blimey, gov kind of thing. But no, the thing, and let me just start this out with, like Jamie Delano a lot. Mm-hmm. But I think some of his, the way he plots a story is really well done. And he's a good writer. He has a predilection for similes and metaphors that just make me roll my eyes. And several times I had a heavy sigh. Wrote a couple down. One, there's the pearls of love in the oyster of life. Really, Jamie? That's what you're going to go with? And the feeling in her gut was like a cold speculum. Wow, dude. That's what you're going to go with.
Well, it feels as if, I mean, he's trying to mix Chandler and Lovecraft.
Yes. Yeah, he's trying to be Lovecraft noir.
Yes.
Which most of the time succeeds, don't get me wrong. It's just every once in a while, these little, how he describes a thing comes up. Those were only two that there were several that I was just like, oh, wow.
Yeah, it goes on a bit. And, you know, again, like I said, I can't believe This ran for 300 issues. It's the longest running. I mean, it didn't start Vertigo, because Vertigo didn't start for several years, but it was a tentpole Vertigo title.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. This and Sandman were it.
One would suggest, now I'm not going to, I'm not talking about quality or what have you, but when I think of Vertigo, I think of Hellblazer first. Mm-hmm. And then I think of Sandman, and then I think of like the Grant Morrison stuff, and then I think of some of the other great, great, great titles that came out of Vertigo. But at the end of the day, Hellblazer started before them all, and it outlasted them all. There's a reason for that. It's not like sales for Hellblazer were out of this world. They kept this title going for as long, like it outlasted everybody else.
Well, it was one of those titles that all the top tier creatives wanted to be a part of.
Very much like Daredevil.
Exactly.
I compare it to Daredevil in some ways.
I was just thinking that actually. But yeah, so, and I think it has the potential because of what you said in the introduction. It is a horror comic, which, you know, people like to write the scary.
Right.
It's also political and social, and there's social commentary. And there's a lot that can be told through this medium. Or through this character and through how his stories are set up. Yeah, so I think that, you know, that is part of why those top-tier creators wanted to be a part of this.
And there was some controversy. There have been a few moments of controversy with the choice of writers in the past. When they, like Brian Azzarello comes to mind immediately, the idea that he shouldn't be writing Hellblazer because he's an American.
Oh,
that was a big thing. And that's still kind of a big thing.
Is it?
And okay. I understand that to a point. I like Brian Azzarello a lot. But I also understand the argument is like how because Constantine is so uniquely, intrinsically British in so many ways. And so I understand, like, again, I like Azzarello's run on it. I'm not criticizing Azzarello writing it. But I understand where people were taken aback because Hellblazer was very much a showcase for British writers.
I get that. But if you're a good writer, you're a good writer. It shouldn't matter where you're from.
Right.
I don't get too precious with it. This is a great character and you want to see what a good or
but I think
good to great writer was going to do with it. Right.
Right. But I think it speaks to the nature of John Constantine and the investment people had with who he is and what he is and how he reacts to certain things. Again, I'm not critiquing other writers writing him. I like virtually every arc in Hellblazer, but I understand, and I think it does speak to there are very few characters in comics that I feel are as unique as John Constantine.
That's true. I agree. And to think that he was just sort of a cameo, one-off background, not background, but, you know, minor character in a different series and has become what he has become. And I do like all kudos to Matt Ryan and his portrayal of live action. You know, did a fine job, but it is television version of John Constantine.
Sure.
And he works much, much better when he's the heavy smoking, cursing, heavy drinking bastard. That
yeah.
John Constantine is in the comics.
And he's a bastard.
Yes, he is.
I have that written multiple times in my notes.
The fact that, again, we'll get into it, but the fact that he cannot, or he's not afraid to screw people over to get the job done.
Well, and I think that's, go ahead.
I was saying, not necessarily to save himself, but it doesn't matter the collateral damage so long as the bad guy gets caught, or right. The bad demon most of the time.
Right. But good and bad, good and evil are pretty amorphous concepts in Hellblazer.
It blurs. Yeah, the lines get blurred a little bit.
Right.
Okay. So there you go.
So that's it. Thank you for visiting our podcast.
Let's talk a little bit about this story. This is kind of broken down into little episodes.
Right.
One, two issue story arcs. And it ends kind of abruptly, this particular trade. So we don't really find out the ultimate conclusion, because we're not going to talk about the Swamp Thing in this particular trade. It has the first nine issues and then two Swamp Thing issues
kind of tie-ins. And I was like, we're not gonna
So we'll just kind of go up to the end of the Hellblazer.
And I guess I should have. I think I like dropped the biggest part in my intro. It should be noted. Let's get this in here. John Constantine was created by Alan Moore. Somehow I left that out of my intro. Kind of important. But so the structure. Yeah,
Alan Moore actually created an original character. That's neat.
Who knew? Well,
yeah, he has it in him.
Sort of. I mean, you know, he was based on. But yes, Alan Moore did create an original character. But so like what you said, so the structure is very interesting. I kind of was trying to read up a little bit extra on this, and because I didn't kind of know this, but Delano wanted these to be kind of singular standalone issues, or like you said, they sometimes it's more two issues. But the first two in particular, which I think we could spend an entire podcast on just the first two issues. I don't want to bug folks, but
Oh, I was waiting to use that joke.
Yeah, well, I think we'll have plenty of opportunities. But what he does do is, so the first two issues are sequential. They tie in. The next seven can be read as standalones, but feed into subsequent issues.
To use a different analogy, it's similar to Buffy the Vampire Slayer, whereas each episode is in his individual story, but they all tie into a whole season arc. Any chance to use Buffy the Vampire Slayer as a reference point?
Which I have never seen, so I can't react properly.
Okay.
But one of the, and like I mentioned in my intro, but one of the most important things about this, these nine issues set the template for the next 291.
Absolutely. A lot of the themes and ideas and characterization of John Constantine are set up right here. They are definitely his original sins.
Most importantly, just the characters that are introduced, from Chaz to Gemma to, you know, Nurgle, and tons of other characters in here. But everything in these nine issues have consequences going forward all the way down the line.
And the history, you know, the weight. John Constantine has been around for a while. He's lived in this world. And you understand that. You understand the weight of his responsibilities and his failures without it being spelled out to you every step of the way. Like, I mean, the biggest thing is Newcastle, of course.
Right. And we get a lot of references in Newcastle. We kind of know what Newcastle is based on. We've covered John Constantine before. Yes.
In a roundabout way, yes.
Yes, in Swamp Thing. And a lot of what happens in the Swamp Thing arc that we covered way back in the day directly affect what's going on now.
Exactly. Or
in these issues. Well, let's talk about the first couple issues. The first couple issues are just horrible.
Yes. It's gross.
And I mean that in a positive.
Yeah. Well, it's gross and horrific. Just the idea of bugs crawling all over people.
Right.
Is just awful. But the decisions that Constantine must make.
At its most generic plotline, there is a demon called, and I'm going to mispronounce this, apologies, Menemoth? Menmoth?
Menemoth.
Menemoth. Which is basically like a bunch of bugs.
Yeah, it's a swarm of different bugs that form a singular entity.
Right. Which creates hunger and basically eats someone from the inside out.
Exactly. And causes that person who is possessed to just eat and devour anything. And literally. Anything.
Whether it be food or whatever is the hunger that the person has, whether it be food or lust or what have you. What has happened, and we get this story kind of in bits and pieces over the two issues. A friend of Constantine's, Gary Lester, who's a severe drug addict. He's William Burroughs.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I guess. Yeah.
A much less cool William Burroughs.
That's what I was thinking. It was like, yeah, it was William Burroughs without all the charisma.
Yeah. Had gone into Africa and was a drug addict and was trying all kinds of exotic drugs. And had at some point, and this is really awful, found a child who was possessed by this demon. And Gary Lester had some magic knowledge and had somehow extracted the demon from this possessed child. I think it's either from the Sudan, I believe.
I thought it was Ethiopia, because then it tied into the famine of Ethiopia.
Right. And had bottled the demon, but then started injecting the demon.
Using the demon as if it were heroin.
Right. And so our first encounter with Gary Lester is he's in John Constantine's bathtub, covered in flies and bugs.
Just crawling all over him. And he's thinking he has DTs or something similar. Absolutely horrible.
But one of the most disturbing panels in comics that I've ever read.
It's actually a pretty, I don't want to say iconic, but it's a famous panel of him sitting in the bathtub. And it was recreated really nicely in the John Constantine Hellblazer TV show. Ooh. The short-lived Matt Ryan TV show. But, you know, by the way, metaphors abound in this series. The hunger of drug addiction, you know, you feed on what you're most addicted to. So whether it be lust or drugs or religion.
Yeah. And this is kind of a famous story. We're recapping stuff which probably a lot of our listeners have read, at least in part. I should stop now and say John Ridgway is the perfect artist for this comic.
I'm going to be a little controversial. This is a personal preference. I don't really like John Ridgway's art.
Okay.
It's not that he's bad. I just don't like that sketchy, overly heavy, sketchy pencil thing that he does.
But I feel like it works really well.
That's what I was going to say is my personal preference is it's not my favorite style of art. However, it does work really well with this, how should you say, dirty, grimy world that Constantine lives in.
It's filthy. This comic looks filthy.
Right. There are some times where you go into someone's bedroom and I'm like, ooh, you lay down in that bed? Oh, God. Okay. Again, it's not my favorite aesthetic, but it works for this comic. You're absolutely right. It works for this comic because there are times where you can almost smell how bad this place is.
Yeah. What follows is John Constantine. He goes, you know, back to Africa and finds some stuff out about the demon, comes back. He takes Gary Lester to New York, which is where Phenomena is kind of wreaking the most havoc, because at some point Gary Lester sent the bottle of demons to New York. It's a long story. It's not super important. It ends up in New York. It's consuming people. It's creating havoc. Constantine takes Gary Lester, his friend, to New York to Papa Midnight.
Papa Midnight, by the way, great, great character, recurring character throughout this series. Papa Midnight is one of those characters where you know, there's a menace around him, but he's really he's really cool at the same time.
Yeah. And he doesn't take shit from John. So through a series of events, Constantine and Papa Midnight use Gary Lester to trap the demon.
So they essentially do a spell so that the demon enters Gary Lester, and then Lester then becomes the host that traps the demon within him. So that Lester will be eaten alive forever.
And they use an electric chair and a straitjacket. I mean, all the horror tropes are there.
Oh, yeah.
And the end result is that, they bring in the demon to consume Gary, and then they wall him up and leave him to, like you said, be either eternally consumed, or at least the demon is captured.
And contained within his body.
And contained within his body.
Which is what, by the way, John Constantine does some last seasons of Game of Thrones traveling time. Because he goes from London to Africa, back to London to New York in like 2 days, something like that.
Maybe.
Yeah. And later, it was very quickly.
He travels. He's in the U.S. somewhere. There's a later story where I'm like, I don't know where he is.
He was in Iowa. He's in Iowa. And then the next day he's back in New York or back in London. Okay.
Yeah.
Jet lag is not a thing for a magician, apparently.
Well,
but his trip to Africa, he finds out why that young boy was that Lester had found. He had been the vessel, and Lester had actually just broken the spell and let Menomina out. The harrowing thing about this is the fact that Constantine knows what he has to do.
Mm-hmm.
And he has to betray his friend and curse him to an eternity of just anguish. Horrible, horrible pain and anguish. forever, but it's for the greater good. And this is where we get what we're talking about. It's like Constantine is willing to make those choices horribly. He feels bad about it, but you know, he still does it.
Yeah.
And it's sad and it's horrifying. And you understand Constantine's motivations. By the way, there's a lot of people who don't pronounce Constantine. They're wrong. It's Constantine. Okay.
Well, there's some controversy on the matter, but I think one of the things that these first two issues do is it establishes, like you just said, establishes a pattern. It establishes him as a bastard who will do anything, you know, like you said, for the greater good. It establishes that being a friend of his is not a great idea.
Because we find out that he is literally haunted by his past.
We bring in the ghosts of his past, and these are very important characters that we will be seeing again and again and again throughout the entirety of Hellblazer. We find out about Emma, who also becomes a very important bit of Hellblazer lore. She is one of the ghosts. She is a former girlfriend. So a lot of this is framing Constantine's character.
He has made a decision long time ago in his life that his job is to stop the demons, stop the evil. Right. And if he has to use and sacrifice people along the way to do so, well, he's willing to do that.
He does, and does often.
Yes. That is the moral of the story. Don't be John Constantine's friend. Even Swamp Thing is like, dude, you're awful.
It's one of the greatest frenemies in all of comics is Swamp Thing and Constantine. They hate each other and yet need each other. They feed off of each other in ways that vary, you know, it's a different relationship than, say, Batman feeding off of Joker and vice versa. It's a very different. Yeah.
It's true. Yeah. Do you want to say more about the bug?
No, I mean, I think, you know, it's a very serious, very horrifying story. There's there's a scene with a preacher that's really quite awful, but it really, these two issues really set us up in a way that in the world of continuity, people are very obsessed with continuity in comics, and oftentimes, you know, things will get retconned. Continuity plays around. My God, Hellblazer follows continuity, religiously.
It does or does it? That's what I was actually trying to think about this, because we listed out that roster of really good writers who are almost every one of them is a master at retconning previous continuity to fit their own.
Sure.
So was this planned out, or was it just that we had just this roster of incredible writers who was able to make it seem as if there was a grand plan? I don't know. It's interesting to think about.
I didn't read all 300 issues for this.
I have read all
300 issues.
Yes.
A couple times, at least, including as they were coming out. It's one of the few comics that I probably have all 300 issues in physical form. I feel as if the general sense of Constantine has been carried through. It's not a comic that we're retconning really works, because if you change the nature of the character, then that character ceases to be the character. I don't know if this makes sense. Like, you can change a superhero's origin around, but with Hellblazer, it has to carry. If Constantine isn't Constantine, then it's not Hellblazer.
Interesting. Okay, I can see that to a certain point. Yeah.
And I feel as if the writers were respectful to the character.
The character of Constantine, I agree with you, remains solid all the way through.
So I think these first two issues really help establish this. And then we get to the third issue, Going For It, which is it's one of the comedic bits.
This is the yuppies.
This is the and so I love that. So Delano never really pretended not to be political.
The A drops references to Thatcher and
this is an like his run on Constantine is extremely political and definitely coming from the left.
Yes. By the way, not a fan of Thatcher.
No.
This is definitely set in a period of time too.
I think very few British writers at the time had many nice things to say about Thatcher.
Well, like, not the ones that we read.
Thatcher's England was very much a whipping post for British comic book writers during the 80s.
Yeah, so this particular issue is about corporate demons, very much akin to Black Monday Murders without all the charts and graphs.
I almost wrote, I did write Black Monday Murders and underline it because it's, you know, we've touched on this and it is there is a...
It's good stuff.
Oh, it's great. No, this is a highly amusing issue. It is. It's Constantine versus Wall Street. Well, it's not Wall Street. This is London. Demon yuppies, demon corporate raiders.
Yeah. Or as we call them, yuppies.
Or yuppies.
It's all very well crafted and it's not subtle in its criticisms.
Completely lacking in subtlety.
Yes, in the business world and the quest for consumption. Quest for consumption? That's not a word. I mean, that's not a phrase. Corporate consumerism and greed. Yeah,
this issue takes place in a single day. It's election day, June 11th, 1987, in which Thatcher is about to be elected again. Thatcher doesn't get elected the way
she's going to stay in power.
The way the elections work in England is slightly different.
Yeah, no one actually knows how that works. It just happens. We kind of pretend we know, but
there's a lot of bits and pieces throughout this issue of like some politics and very anti-corporate, anti-Wall Street, or I keep wanting to say Wall Street. Same thing, you know. It's and Blathoxy he's dressed in like, you know, the suit, you know,
the pinstripe suit. Yeah.
Incredibly obese demon whose whole shtick is making transactions, like corporate transactions, and everything is a corporate transaction. What's great about this issue is the end when we really see how Constantine can manipulate. This isn't the first time Constantine offers to sell his soul by a long shot, but one of my favorite things about this is this is where we really see how good he is at manipulating people, or manipulating demons, or manipulating situations.
Well, this is what you were talking about, how this is the template going forward, and it shows how he gets out of things with his smarts, his ability to gamble and risk.
Right. As a powerful magician, I think I read someone, you know, when I was reading up this, someone made a good point. It's like, even though he's one of the most powerful magicians in the world, he chooses to use his, you know, his wiles as opposed to using actual magic.
He's a con man.
Right.
But he chooses to use his cons for good.
So the resolution of this is fun because he approaches Blathoxy and offers to sell his soul and fools Blathoxy into thinking that Constantine knows something about the election that's happening that day. Because Blathoxy is assuming that the Tories will win. But then suddenly he's like, wait, Constantine's selling his soul, which means he knows something that I don't know. And so Constantine fools Blathoxy into thinking that Labor's going to win, or the left is going to win. So Blathoxy refuses to purchase Constantine's soul and then turns around and starts selling his shares or what have you in the Tories, thinking that the left is going to win. And Blathoxy ends up getting completely financially ruined because, of course, the Tories win.
So that, you know, in the finance, it's all based on soul. So he's Blathoxy's trying to buy the left souls so that he has he's going to corner the market on liberal souls, because when they're in power, he can have them. But it's all a ruse, and Constantine tricks him out of basically the market crashes. That's very clever.
Yeah, it's but of course, then the comic ends. You know, the demons aren't happy. They leave Constantine tied upside down in front of a television where he has to watch, like, Margaret Thatcher, like...
Yeah, give her acceptance speech and all that.
Give her acceptance speech. And I think Blathoxy, you know, even tells Constantine as he leaves him behind, he says, there's more than one road to hell.
Again, not
hanging
subtle.
Hanging upside down with only a TV to watch with having to listen to Thatcher certainly seems like a road to hell to me.
That is an extreme form of torture.
After all of, so we have the a bit of a humorous issue, and then we hit Waiting for the Man, which really starts to pull in some religious aspects that carry through to the rest of at least these nine issues. Actually carry on throughout. Constantine continually has issues with religion, but
which makes perfect sense.
Right. It's, yeah. So the next issue, Waiting for the Man, issue 4, is where we're introduced to both the Resurrection Crusade, the Damnation Army, and John Constantine's niece, Gemma. Yes. Oh, and also Zed. It's a weird issue because, like, a lot of stuff happens. Some of it's kind of a generic kidnapping story. Kinda. In some ways, but I feel like it's used as a springboard for some really important stuff that happens later.
Yes, well, it's kind of a foreshadowing to what's going to happen to Zeb.
Right. So,
but it's also incredibly disturbing as well.
It's a very disturbing, it's a very unpleasant issue in some ways. Constantine's niece Gemma, she's not kidnapped. But she ends up, so she's lonely because her parents have joined this weird cult called the Resurrection Crusade. Mm-hmm. And they've been moved into this weird development housing where all these wacky kind of religious folks are living. It's a pyramid scheme. It's referred to as a prayer pyramid scheme throughout this issue and subsequently. So Gemma is somehow lured into this house by these three girls who are around her age, who are then going to get married. So they want her to marry this man that they live with.
These three girls are essentially ghosts, which we find. Right.
We find out later that they're ghosts. And this strange man who is wearing like military gear is going to marry her. And by that, he means kill her.
And keep a spirit around. It's not, I'm actually kind of glad they don't spell this out too much of right. What happens here. Mm-hmm. It's very disturbing.
At the end of the day, Constantine saves the day. As he does. I'm not giving, I know I'm skipping over some things, but just so, you know, he rescues his niece, but not until after, she's in the process of the wedding to creepy guy. And, Constantine rescues her.
Well, it's an interesting idea that the religious fundamentalists have their own form of magic, which is perfectly fine. But when Constantine tries to use his magic, he's a conjurer and a Satanist.
Right. I mean, there is a lot of conflict. When Constantine shows up to his sister and her husband's home, these wackadoodle religious types who are called the Resurrection Crusade are there, and we just need to pray it through. And yeah, so Constantine is using his magic and they don't like that.
What does show a little, you know, all the shades of gray between Constantine, the religious people, and the demons, they're all not good. You know, there's no real good guy here. I mean, we follow John Constantine because, you know, he's the protagonist of the comic, but right. He's not a great guy either.
No. And the biggest takeaway, first of all, we're introduced to Gemma, who is an important character later on as well, and that's his niece. And we're introduced to this character named Zed. Constantine just meets this woman on the street. They are about to engage in some sexy time when Constantine finds out his niece has been kidnapped. And so he takes Zed with him to to rescue his niece. And it turns out that she has some powers of her own and may or may not have a relationship to the Resurrection Crusade.
Or a subset thereof. Yes.
And so there's a great scene where Zed, when they rescue Gemma and her captor, the guy that was going to marry and kill her, Zed beats the living shit out of him with some rage that we're like, well, where did this come from? She's obviously having a pretty strong reaction to whatever's going on here.
I did like that she also hits the guy with a bottle. And I like the idea. The bottle did not shatter. It just boom, hits her, and then it hits him again and again and again. Yeah. You know, if you ever hit somebody with a bottle, I don't recommend doing that. It's not going to shatter like it does in a Western.
And we also find out at the end that her captor has a tattoo on his belly that says Damnation Army.
Something that's been popping up around London.
So this is an issue that's very horrific. It's a tough read, but it is used in some ways as a setup for what's coming.
It is very creepy. It is very disturbing. The child endangerment idea is always going to be a tough read.
It is. And I get why it's used. At the end of the day, it's a compelling, people view these things as compelling reading because, or watching. It's like people watching those crime shows.
It's not poorly written and it's not poorly depicted. It's just disturbing subject matter that might not be for everyone.
But at the same time, it's an issue of Hellblazer. So
yes, exactly.
I don't want to say par for the course, but kind of par for the course.
If you're not into the horrific, maybe give Hellblazer a pass.
So then we jump forward to the next issue, unless do you have anything more to say about?
No.
I really feel like this issue was scene setting.
I agree.
And again, like the next couple issues feel a lot like that as well. The next issue, John ends up in Iowa because he's chasing, apparently he's supposed to meet Swamp Thing for something, but then he gets distracted because he sees something about the Damnation Army and he remembers that. So he ends up in this weird town in Iowa where all of their children, their adult, you know, their 18-year-old and older children had been sent to Vietnam and they all died except one guy.
Yes, who's back and he's a little bit on edge, let's say.
He's a bit off.
Yeah.
And so it turns out that the Resurrection Crusade has shown up in this town and they're manipulating the townspeople into praying their children back, their soldiers back.
Yes, the Ponzi scheme of prayer has been explained to us.
Yeah,
where they pay a certain amount of money and their prayers kind of go up a list, and once they get to the top, then they can be nationally prayed for.
Yes,
it's not too far off.
No, and it's again, Delano is very connected to social issues. And yes, has a strong feeling about things that definitely the writer's voice comes through. I have to be like, I like Jamie Delano, but we definitely in these issues, the writer's voice sometimes is stronger occasionally than the characters' voices. Does that make sense? Yeah. And yeah. This is kind of a generic trope story that has been played before. So at some point, time gets wacky and suddenly the soldiers are in Vietnam, but they're also in modern day.
There's a fluctuation in the time-space continuum.
Yes, where, thank you.
Yes, where a horrific incident in Vietnam kind of merges with modern day so that the soldiers actually, they think they're massacring Vietnamese, but they end up massacring their own village.
Their own families in modern time. And through a wacky series of events, the entire populace of this town, Liberty. Oh, the town is called Liberty. I dropped one of the most important. Town is called Liberty.
Of course.
And through a wacky series of events, as can only happen in Hellblazer, basically the entire town is decimated when an oil tanker blows up.
Well, so in the Vietnam side of this, they call it a napalm attack.
Mm-hmm.
But in the Liberty side of things, an oil tanker explodes. The results are the same.
And it's because the soldiers shot at it thinking it was a plane coming. We've read this story a million times.
If you took John Constantine out of this story and just had it play out, it's a Stephen King short story.
Or an EC comic.
That kind of thing. Exactly. And honestly, this one kind of left me a little bit cold, not because of the subject matter, but because Constantine spends the whole time as a voyeur.
He runs and hides.
Yeah. And he says, well, there's nothing I can do right now. Why not? Because because the writer doesn't want me to. Okay, right. Fair enough.
Yeah. Or because he doesn't have an investment in what's going on, he doesn't feel the need to intervene.
And this just has a feel of being, I don't want to say filler, that's not the right word, but there's all this storyline going on in London, then he's in Iowa, then he's back in London.
Right.
It just seems like an outlier in this whole series.
Yeah, Delano was using this as an opportunity to talk about the Resurrection Crusade a little bit more while telling, a kind of, it's the most generic of the stories in these 9 issues. Because, like I said, it just feels like he's just retelling a story that we've already read.
Exactly. A lot of generic.
That's me saying for the third time the same thing.
Yes. A lot of generic storylines.
So I'm mirroring the story.
So a lot of stereotypes, a lot of generic plot lines. This one,
it's
fine.
It's fine. It's a horror story from 1988, 89. So then we get to like the next issue, which I also feel is the story itself is inconsequential, but the ramifications are pretty important. And again, it's one of these where there it's more introduction. It's just more introduction. It's more building Constantine's character and his world. Yeah. And the next story is basically like Delano's taking on like the skinheads of England or the skinheads of London, you know, the Oys.
The soccer hooligan skinheads.
Right.
Yes. I guess they're not soccer hooligans. Sorry.
With a slightly humorous ending.
Okay. This is what I want to say about this one is... I remember reading this. I don't know if it was at the time or around, you know, contemporaneously. I don't know, hipster 20-year-old, man in his 20s reading this comic. And the ending, I was just like, oh, that is the most brilliant thing I've ever read. I remember thinking,
right?
Yeah. So these skinhead hooligans, just to set the scene, they wander into a demon gay bar, which is very strange.
Right. Yeah. And so it's this is set up. This is one of the big things Delano is doing with this and a few subsequent issues is attacking homophobia.
Right. So he goes in. There happens to be some demons in there. They take these hooligans and they get killed, torn up, and put back together as this monstrosity, four-headed, four-armed, four-legged, racist machine that the demons then set off into the real world.
Right. And it's they go by the name of Iron Fist the Avenger, which if that wasn't a poke at the competition, I don't know what is.
Maybe so. But the big conclusion was this thing breaks into Zed's apartment, and Constantine confronts the Iron Fist the Avenger and just starts laughing and then realizes that on one of the arms is a tattoo of Arsenal and then on the other one is Chelsea. Constantine points this out, and they of course hate each other. So this monstrosity begins to rip itself apart.
Beats itself up.
It beats itself up, which is a not so subtle reference to hate will just tear itself apart.
Right. Yeah. So it's again, it's kind of, it's like the third issue where there's some humor involved, but there's also something very serious, a couple of various serious things. So first of all, we have the introduction of Nurgle.
Yes.
The demon Nurgle, an extremely important part of Hellblazer lore.
Did I do that? Oh, no, that's the demon Urkel. Sorry.
We also have, we had been introduced to John's friend, Ray Mond before, and he's a very Quentin Crisp, grand, Queen of England type of individual. And at some point he reveals to John that he has AIDS.
In a very, okay, how do I phrase this? A very tender moment for the time.
Yes.
I think this was really well done.
Yeah.
Because it's, you know, we've read Spectre recently, which dealt with AIDS in a not so good way. But this was, you know, Raymond makes this confession and Constantine just walks over and puts his hand on his shoulder.
Yeah.
Shows a tender, and it's just, it deals with the subject, especially at a time when it was not very well known.
No.
There was a lot of fear and a lot of hatred around it.
And Raymond even has, I don't know if it's in this issue, but at some point, it may be in a later issue, it may be the bad issue for him, where he talks about how no one is going to care about this disease until
the straights get it.
Until straight people start dying of it. And I think this is one of those moments where Jamie Delano really hits it and does a really good job, because these aren't like extensive panels. These are small moments. And he has these in his run that not only show Constantine in a light that shows his humanity, but also shows Delano's humanity and the humanity of the world and the contrast of hate and love.
Yes. Yes. And Delano, he handles this subject, which was very much not known or not treated well, but he handles it with kindness and compassion.
Yeah, this was a time when the only people reporting on the disease in any serious way was a stinking music magazine that came out monthly.
Exactly, exactly.
Who probably had some of the best coverage. Anybody who remembers the 80s will know which music magazine that is. It wasn't Rolling Stone.
Yeah, so I was actually kind of pleasantly surprised at how well that was handled. Not just for the time. It's very well written.
And again, important, but also not to diminish the hilarity of skinheads beating themselves up, yes, which is always a lovely thing.
Yes, hate tore itself apart. And again, it doesn't hold up as, it's still good. I remember rereading this and thinking, man, I honestly could remember reading this for the first time in my 20s, just thinking, oh, dude, this is like masterpiece. Doesn't quite reach those heights for me now, but it's still pretty good.
So the next issue, Ghost in the Machine, was Jamie Delano clearly reading William Gibson.
Yes, my goodness. The late 80s and 90s, their idea of what virtual reality is just so funny.
Yeah, but this was edgy stuff at the time, right?
I guess so.
This had to be 89, 88. It started in 88, so this was at least 88, maybe 89. Definitely not 90 yet.
Well, yeah.
I didn't know what the internet was in 1989.
No, I'm pretty sure I didn't know what the internet was until late 90s.
I was taking a computer class in high school. The computer class was these ancient looking now by our computers, and it wasn't a class, it was like an elective, like where I would just sit and write code or copy code from a book into something else, and when I got done I would have like a 8-bit character like move twice.
Exactly.
I was like, wow, this is amazing.
Yeah, it's just so funny. And it wasn't the internet, it was the information superhighway.
So Ghost of the Machine is one very important and sad thing happens.
Well, this just shows Constantine's character again. He kind of acts in a compassionate way in a roundabout horrible thing.
He's trying to get information on the Resurrection Crusade. So he hooks up with his friend Richie, who is the last of the Newcastle group that's still alive. And he asks Richie to help him find information because Richie is a quantum magician. So Richie can use magic with computers or sort of quantum ideas. And so.
And lots and lots of weed.
So he gets Richie to enter the computer, right? And go into the information superhighway.
Exactly.
So Richie enters the computer, or his consciousness enters the computer. His body stays behind.
And so Richie floats along circuitries, man. He goes through it. He gets through the firewalls. I don't even think they call it a firewall.
Yeah, I don't. Yeah,
so basically it's that weird thing where the consciousness can float through all the different circuitries and through the motherboards, man. It's fun. I love seeing how technology is depicted back then when it's all so new.
Yeah, but it's kind of forward. Like when I'm reading that now, thinking this is 1989, and I get like I don't remember when William Gibson wrote Neuromancer, but it has to be around that time.
Neuromancer came out late 80s, I think.
Yeah, it's kind of wacky in some ways, except it's really tragic because Richie's body spontaneously combusts.
Well, he gets to the Resurrection Crusade.
Yeah.
What we would, I guess, computer central location,
right.
And it sends a feedback loop which burns up Richie's body. So there's nothing to return to it. His consciousness attempts to return to his body, but
he's trapped in the computer. He's trapped in the information superhighway.
Exactly.
So yet again, again, Richie was part of the Newcastle group, and people who know Hellblazer are familiar with that, so we don't have to go into the history there. But again, it's another friend of Constantine's that he sacrifices. And the weirdest part is, so Richie's body spontaneously combusts. He's trapped in the computer, so Constantine turns it off?
He unplugs it. I guess because he wanted to save him from that life of just bodiless, incorporeal nothingness, I guess.
It kind of felt like, as excited as Richie was when he was like going through the information superhighway, I'm just going to keep calling it that. It sort of feels like Richie might have been like, okay, well, I'll just live here.
Exactly. Give him the opportunity. Keep the computer on. In a few years, you will have the internet. You can join chat groups and all kinds of stuff.
He might have been, kind of been like, okay, well, this is good. This sucks. I can't get back to my body, but I wasn't getting laid anyway. So I'm like,
and
instead, Constantine just
he has a limited form of immortality,
right?
And in less than a decade, there will be so much porn for him to interact with. it could be heaven. Who knows?
You know, so all of this is, we're kind of making fun of it. It's, you know, it's weird. It's part of like reading sci-fi and horror when it's written before certain advancements are made in the world.
It's very Lawnmower Man.
So we laugh about it a little bit, but this issue also has an extremely serious moment where Constantine has left Zed with Rey.
Yeah, this is awful.
The Resurrection Army shows up because they're very interested in Zed for reasons we find out later. Rey and Zed have a really nice conversation, and then the Resurrection Army shows up and captures and, you know, abducts Zed and then kills Rey. Beats him to death. This is always a problematic moment, and I understand why it's done. And I understand that this was done before it became more prevalent to do to LGBTQ community.
Well, kill your gays has always been a trope.
Yes.
It's before people started pointing it out, like fridging.
Right.
It was something that happened for many, many years. And it wasn't until, I guess, a few years from now in the mid-90s when people said, you know what, this is a thing that happens entirely too often.
It was not a thing that was happening in comics.
No,
it wasn't. Level, because it wasn't even addressed in comics to the level that Hellblazer did right off the bat. But it's like reading it now, it really bothers me. But I think reading it then, it wouldn't have as much.
It was. It does fit the theme of.
I mean, it would have bothered me. I would have been sad.
Yeah. No, I mean, it fits the theme of what we said before, attacking bigotry. I mean, Delano is definitely coming at this from this is wrong. He's trying to make it visceral to you that hatred is wrong,
right?
That racism is wrong. Reading it in with modern eyes, it does. It seems gratuitous. However, at the time, it was, I don't want to say poignant.
It was an attempt to be poignant, and it may have been at a time before it became...
Right. It would have read differently at the time.
Yeah. But at the same time, yeah, it sucked. Again, this goes back to, like, Constantine's character. So pulling back, Constantine is taking a train home.
This confounded me, by the way, but continue.
I get really confused in the next issue.
Yes.
Where exactly Constantine is. But at some point, Constantine is experiencing regret and sadness about Richie, who he just killed by unplugging the computer, and he jumps out of the movie train.
Yeah, so all the throughout this series, the ghosts of people he has wronged or killed keep haunting him. They keep trying to confront him. And he, of course, being John Constantine, tries to ignore it and run away. But he jumps off a moving train to avoid these ghosts. And it's just so stupid, to put it bluntly.
Yeah, it's a weird motivation. I understand when I read the next issue why they had to have Constantine jump out of a moving train, because they needed him to be badly injured. But
just have like a thug throw him off the train.
Yeah, you know, just, well, I mean... I think they were trying to show him experiencing regret, which they show constantly in Hellblazer. He is haunted by his ghosts throughout the entire series.
Right.
These ghosts never go away. They never go away.
We are always haunted by the ghosts of our past, man.
So we get to, so this leads into issue 8, which is a weird issue because very little happens in issue 8, except for one of the most important things in the history of Hellblazer.
Which is he gets licked by a demon.
He gets licked by a demon. So one of the very few important things in it, I feel like there's only two things that happen in this that really matter. One is that we find out that Zed, her real name is Mary, her father is the head of the Resurrection Crusade. They have captured her so that they can re-indoctrinate her because she's going to be the savior.
She's going to be the mother. Yeah, she's going to be the mother
of the next Jesus.
Yeah, she's going to be Mary.
So we find that out. And then we spend a lot of chatty time between Nurgle and Constantine, in which some babies are threatened and Nurgle's being a demon and doing demon-y things. Nurgle wants John Constantine to join the Damnation Army to fight against the Resurrection Crusade. Fantastic.
He doesn't take sides, man.
Yeah. Except he kind of does.
Except what he does. Well, he doesn't take the fundamentalist route. So the Damnation Armies, a little bit too far to the demon side, and then the Resurrection Crusades, a little bit too far to the opposite end of that.
For whatever motivation Constantine has, he agrees to. Well, no, he agrees because he's going to save the baby. Because right. Nurgle is going to like kill a baby, so Constantine's like, okay, I'll join the Damnation Army, or I'll help you out to fight the Resurrection Crusade, which he'd like to do anyway.
Yeah.
But then he tells Nurgle, like, so Constantine's in a hospital bed with like a full body cast and whatever, and he's like, well, I can't do anything in this.
Exactly.
And so Nurgle offers to heal him, and what does Nurgle do? He injects John Constantine with his blood.
Yes, so he has. So John Constantine now has demon blood coursing through his veins.
Yes, yeah. Which becomes an issue for the next 292 issues.
Indeed, but there is something that's very interesting that Delano does here as well, which is Constantine and Zed have had sex. When Zed's kidnapped to the Resurrection Crusade, they have the doctors looking her over, and they say, "Well, is she?" You know,
she's not clean.
She's not clean anymore. And he said, well, virginity's like, it's preferable, but we could work around it. Mm-hmm. Which I liked the idea of that, you know, we are fundamentalists and we believe these things, but you know, if it's a little bit too difficult to follow these rules, we can bend them.
Right.
Delano does, it's a very interesting little commentary on the nature of belief. As long as we get what we want, the beliefs can be bent and changed. Unless, of course,
we get to the final issue of this series, possibly the most compromised of these issues. Most of this issue is just a whole bunch of fever dream crap.
Yeah,
and I'm not a fan of fever dream stuff, so maybe you like it more than I do. It very much fits in the horror aspect of it, but it's just, I don't even know where, is he in Gotham? Is he in London? I think he's in Gotham. Did he go to Gotham? And then Gotham is, there's wrecking balls all over the place. Wrecking balls seem to be a theme in this issue.
There's a wrecking ball going on. I thought he was still in London, to be honest with you.
I thought he was in London too, but then he gets on a plane to go to London. It was very confusing because he was in Glastonbury in the last issue. That's where he jumped out. But he wouldn't take a plane from Glastonbury to, well, maybe he would. But I felt like he was in the U.S. There was, you know what, some of this doesn't matter.
So the wrecking ball was just the thing that's placed there because he's going to try to kill himself.
Mm-hmm.
So he sees the wrecking ball, so he just wants to get wrecked, basically.
Everywhere he goes, he's walking around this burnt out city and there's constantly wrecking balls going on all around him.
Yeah, he's in a state because of the demon blood. He's out of his mind a little bit.
He's out of his mind on and it's his birthday. It's his 35th birthday. It's May 10th. Happy birthday, John. You know, and he's haunted by his ghosts throughout the whole thing. I mean, it's all very, very much like, you know, the style of the horror and supernatural aspect.
Yes, he is haunted by a ghost to come to a revelation about himself.
And this isn't the first or last time by any stretch that we see Constantine moving from his dapper self to a more dilapidated self. This is a constant.
A Constantine. This is when his tie is really loose rather than just slightly loose. Right,
than just slightly askew.
Yes.
Eventually he gets his shit together.
Which, okay, you know, full credit to Ridgway on this one. He's sitting on this couch in the broken down building. We see the wrecking ball coming and he gets up and leaves just as the wrecking ball hits. So he does.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's visually very compelling. Very well done.
So then he goes, he does head back to London. There is a scene where he's in an airport and it says London. He gets back to London and he goes to rescue Zed,
yes.
Who doesn't want to be rescued because she's been brainwashed and is accepting her fate.
John says, let's just have some sexy fun time one last time.
One last time. And she agrees to it.
And he knows full well with his demon nature now, she will not be fit to carry the baby of the savior.
He knows full well that he is about to taint her with demon blood. Now, I have a couple questions. First of all, we've been talking about AIDS.
Yes, this is what I was going to bring up as well.
Yeah.
So
we've been talking about AIDS in these issues. I have in huge letters two things. John Constantine is a bastard.
Yes.
And was this sexual assault?
It's so tough, dude. I don't think it's assault.
He knowingly infected her without her consent.
I mean, she consented to the sex, so it wasn't a rape.
She didn't.
Yes, but he knowingly infected. Yeah, God, that's so.
We are giving a 2023 reading to a 1989 comic book.
Which is perfectly fine. You know, if it's a good story, it should hold up. Reading things from a modern viewpoint, we learn stuff over the years. But yes, even from a 1989 viewpoint, he infected her. He did that knowingly and deliberately.
Yeah.
And he he manipulated the situation.
Because that's what John Constantine does. And this to me is like this is part of why I love the character so much as a creation. I love is the wrong, you know what I mean. I'm not, I don't love that he, this is one of the things that makes him such a compelling and problematic character. Now, this is how he was written by this author in this story.
Delano wrote, I mean, we were just praising him for his manipulation tactics.
Right.
And how he gets through things. And yes, he's willing to make the hard choices to save for the greater good.
But this is exactly why that John Constantine, who nobody ever calls the Hellblazer, is at the end of the day, such a compromised character. Because this isn't the first awful thing he's done, and this ending is really problematic for me.
Yeah, it's not out of character for him, though. We've already seen him betray one of his friends in order to trap a demon inside them.
Right.
We've seen him be manipulative in order to get his way. So this is not out of character. He's doing what John Constantine does, but the fact that he's doing it, I don't know. This just does seem more wrong for some reason.
Yeah. And, you know, and I understand that we've spent this time praising John Constantine as a great character.
And he is a great character. This just adds to us, you know, I hate him, but I really like him.
And again, this is how this particular writer wrote his character here. And to damn a fictional character, particularly in comics, because the way one writer wrote them is problematic. In the same way that Hank Pym, is Hank Pym forever damned?
No.
Because of one way that he was written, there's a lot of people who like have never forgiven a fictional character for a terrible thing they did. It's this is a really, this last part of issue 9 is creates a lot of conflict that, to be honest, I know we're supposed to be sitting here going, well, my opinion is blah, blah, blah. I don't have an answer on this one.
No, but I don't either. It is incredibly interesting to dive a little bit deeper into it. It says a lot about who we are, that we're able to praise this character doing the exact same thing in one situation, but condemn him in a different situation. We could get all Freudian on that and really delve deep into our own characters, but we're not going to do that. But no, but it's interesting. And that's what I think. That's why this series lasted for 300 issues.
Mm-hmm.
Because these are very difficult situations and difficult situations to confront for the reader.
Yeah.
And this is why so many good, you know, that roster of creatives wanted to work on this title.
Why everybody, and not just the writers, but the artists. I mean, my God, the artists that lined up to write to illustrate Hellblazer. And, you know, Dave McKeon did the covers for a long time, too, initially. But it's such a morally compromised fictional character that, you know, again, it just...
It's compelling because there are no easy answers.
It is. And what happens going forward and all of, I mean, he does horrible, horrible things, not just this, but other things going forward. And then DC, you know, once the Vertigo series ended, DC brought him back in and kind of used him as a cartoon.
Yeah.
Like a one-note character. And same with, like you said, I like Matt Ryan and I like, you know, the way he's presented in the Constantine TV show and then in Legends of Tomorrow is very different than how he's presented in the comics.
Yes, it's very sanitized.
Yeah, which it has to be.
Of course. You couldn't do storylines like this Like, you know, unless you're doing like HBO or something like that.
Right.
But on the CW, yeah, you're not going to be doing this storyline.
No.
In different iterations for different formats and different media. But this particular series, this Hellblazer Vertigo 300 issue series, is groundbreaking.
You know? Oh, yeah.
And it allowed writers and artists to really delve deep into the gray areas of ethics and morality. And that's why there are no easy answers.
And there are lots of those. And this is what Jamie Delano did, was he created, I think, in this a template. And I know, you know, I really think that a lot of what happens in these 9 issues have a incredibly strong effect on every writer that came after, up through Peter Milligan, who ended the series.
I think through, who was it, Charles Soule, who wrote the most recent run. Was it Charles Soule?
Spurrier actually wrote the most recent.
Spurrier, I'm sorry, yeah. It was Spurrier.
And that was great.
Yeah.
I think I've already complained about that getting canceled.
Right. I'm sorry, it was Spurrier. That's who I'm thinking of. But that was still very consistent. That his run could have quite easily have been slotted into 301 to 312, you know, of this run. Very consistent. Anywho, John Constantine is a really compelling and interesting character, one that we're not doing justice to, I don't believe.
No, but I mean, you know, we're also not talking about them, you know.
We're not doing a deep dive. But you know, and of course, we got to quickly mention Keanu Reeves.
And I'm glad we did. So moving...
I kind of think that that movie is really good. It's not John Constantine, but it's a really good horror movie. Not John Constantine.
We love Keanu Reeves. This is a Keanu Reeves safe space.
Yes.
But Keanu Reeves is John Constantine.
It's got Shia LaBeouf in it too. So yeah. Anywho, I just wanted to mention that. But Hellblazer, we could do an entire podcast on this run,
which we won't. But anyway, that's the first 9 issues of Hellblazer, kids.
Really good stuff. Really hard reading, you know.
Yeah, in some cases.
Yeah.
Sometimes really funny stuff.
Yeah. But remember, just find all the love in life's oyster that you possibly get.
And scene.
I think we're done. Thanks for recommending this. Brian, everyone, who, if you haven't read the Vertigo version of Hellblazer, go do it. It's good stuff. It'll take you a little bit of time. It's 300 issues. Worth
it. And that's not counting all the stuff before and all the specials and the miniseries and the... Yeah, so that was fun. Lighthearted. Good times. Paul, I believe you are up next for a recommendation. Would you like to tell us what that is?
Yes, I do. Next time on an all-new edition of the Collected Edition, we are going to be reading Creature Commandos by J.M. DeMatteis, and then later written by Robert Conniger.
Okay.
Midway through the run. And it's illustrated by Pat Broderick.
All right.
Yeah. This is the 1980s run of Weird War Tales. This is back when we were still doing strange anthology comics.
Love strange anthology comics.
Yeah. So Weird War Tales, you know, we'd have Sergeant Rock and stuff like that in there.
Yeah.
But so Creature Commandos, you got your werewolves and your vampires and your Frankenstein monsters fighting World War II. It's good stuff. So that's it. I have all kinds of jokes about a vampire, a werewolf, and a Frankenstein monster walking to a war. Got anything else?
No, I'm all set. I'm looking forward to the jokes, though.
Okay, good. So, like to hear what your feedback is. Leave us a comment on the website, collectiveditionpodcast.com, or on the Twitters and all that stuff. And that's it. I'm just going to end it there.
Okay.
Okay.
And be well.
Oh, keep reading comics.
And be well.
There you go.
You've been listening to The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast. The Collected Edition is a Daddy Elk production. All materials used on the show are copyright their respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended. The show can be found on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play, as well as online at collectededitionpodcast.com, where comments can be left on individual episodes. You can also send us feedback at comments@collectededitionpodcast.com or on Twitter @collectededpod. That's collected, EDPOD. The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast, is for entertainment purposes only.